Hey, it's the Roller Out the Barrel podcast. Oh, we are recording this. We're actually recording right now. It's amazing. I see the numbers turning. It's a beautiful thing. Today on the show, I have from the Cincinnati Buckeyes, Landon Yeti Smith. Landon, how you doing today?
I'm good, man. How you doing, man?
Hey, let's pretend I'm doing great. Thanks for asking. Let's pretend this is the first time this is happening because we just recorded, I don't know, about 7 minutes that I didn't record. So let's go back in time and pretend like we're meeting for the first time, even though now I know more about you. Why does your father abuse you? We're not going to give any context.
We didn't get into the story today. There's a lot of recall that I abused him. There is nothing that I never said that he abused me. I'm just saying that the jury's still out there.
We know some stories now about how Landon and his father aren't allowed to be together because somebody always gets hurt. And I did a callback without any of you knowing what the heck I was talking about. So it was funny for me and for Landon. Oh, well. Hey, Landon, you've been a member of the Cincinnati Buckeyes for 7 years now, if our friendship tells me correctly. And, boy, you're coming in at a tall 6'5", I would say. Would you say 6'5" is correct?
I'd say it's a good 6'5".
Oh, yeah. I can size people up pretty good. So you, as a member of the Cincinnati Buckeyes, you travel around and play with the Red Stockings, I believe, at quite a few events. Why don't you talk about that for a little bit?
So the Cincinnati Buckeyes and the Cincinnati Red Stockings are part of the same baseball club, but just two teams. So it's part of the Cincinnati Baseball Association. And we commonly are invited out to events, historical societies. There's an event in Louisville that we play that's like an ice cream social that we go to, and we play a game of Bound. They prefer the game of Bound. We do play Fly, primarily. But a lot of the organizations, we probably play the Red Stockings maybe 4 to 6 times a year. And often enough, when we invite clubs into our field, usually you play doubleheaders against both clubs. It kind of make the travel worth the while.
And so you guys probably play at least 25 matches a year, am I right? Probably rains a lot, though.
Yeah. Man, you check the weather down here? Everything?
Well.
Crazy Kreskin over here. We do get a lot of rain out, oddly enough, in the beginning of the year. And, usually it's around 20, 30 games we play. And depending on, the stack up and how the weather holds out.
And while we're talking about the Cincinnati Buckeyes, what's your favorite field to play on? This is a question that came in by Kyle Nicely.
Man, you said that name a lot better that time.
Yeah, thank you.
So Danny Lyon Field is our home field. It's there's no pop culture associated with the field, but it's a nice, fairly level field. Pretty open, no obstructions or anything. And then there's a nice sloping hill, probably about 300 feet out, that kind of creates a nice stadium atmosphere. And it's also associated with a historical village. So it's one thing that's kind of odd is there was a poll out there about up there in Michigan. I think you might have started it about what were the best fields out there. And Marbles picked Dandelion Fields as one of the best places he's ever played.
Really? So there's no obstruction on that field, just a flat, nothing in the way. I don't mean to make it sound boring. I've never been there. But you don't like to play on fields that have a little something in the way.
I'm pretty accident prone, so whatever is in the way, uh-huh, I'm going to be playing and flirting with.
So it's probably an obstacle that your father put out on the field. And you find, so you go down to Greenfield Village last year for the first time in the world, if I've read your biography correctly, and you were a member of the Black Flags of Droverton, and that wasn't your first time there playing, right? You've gone there as a member of the Buckeyes, right?
Yes, we went up and played the Nationals. We try to go up there every other year to try out Michigan.
Do you travel up to Michigan with the Buckeyes to play any other Michigan teams, or do you just play them by chance in some tournaments in Ohio?
Primarily, since I've been on the team, and that we've mostly played them over there at the Ohio Cup, because we've played Old Golds there before. We did have Canton came down and played us at home, and we have had the Wyandotte Stars.
Yeah, Stars come down and play
against us. Yeah. So we've had a couple teams come down to us, but we haven't done a whole lot in the Michigan.
The Wyandotte Stars are a bunch of great guys. I love the Wyandotte Stars. Canton is a young club. They probably ran for days all over you on the field, and their girlfriends haven't put their foot down yet, so they travel a lot. But it's coming.
It's
coming. They don't think it's coming, but it's coming. Hey, speaking of Greenfield Village, I just got a question in from Chris Hunter, and I don't know if you're familiar with Chris Hunter, but his thoughts.
I am familiar with Butcher.
Oh, okay. He wants to know your thoughts of finally playing at Greenfield Village, but you didn't finally play at Greenfield Village. But what's it like to play at Greenfield Village?
It is a stack upon a stack of talented people who all are as hungry as you are and ready to run on you. And it was great. So it was great to know that everywhere you're going to hit that ball, there's somebody that's going to pick the ball up and probably try to throw you out wherever you are at any point in time. It was kind of interesting to be in that level of competition and at all aspects and everything like that. And to see a large crowd gathered there to see you, and I don't know how many people came up and were asking, like, did you guys all play college ball? Where did you play at? No, I completely skipped those years.
You run into skilled ball players pretty much anywhere you go, but you go to Greenfield Village for the World's Tournament, and the baseball IQ is ramped up like nowhere else.
Severely.
If you don't have your head in the game, it's going to cost you plenty. So, yeah, that's I've played at the Worlds many times with the Bay City Independents. That was a great experience. Really taught me something new about vintage baseball that I hadn't known at that point. And I always look forward. Now being on a club that's not really up to that caliber, I really enjoy going as a spectator. It's just as much fun, actually. So, Jim Willison, which is the captain of the Oaks of Locust Corner, the former Moscow Monarchs. He wants to know how you got your nickname, the Yeti.
Well, in hindsight, it's kind of surprised it didn't come up before. But I have kind of like a niche of some of the women in my life. I give them like non-assuming nicknames, like my mother-in-law is Diesel. My grandmother is East Beast, and then this other lady I was hanging out with doing some geocaching hobbies, and I was always picking on her with a nickname, and she didn't really care. I was always just calling her, "Gosh, you're so beastly," you know. And her knee-jerk reaction was just, "You're just a stupid Yeti," and it kind of stuck. It makes sense, you know. Wear a size 16 shoe. Tall, very pale,
but
like
you're
the cold and snow.
But you're a ginger, aren't you?
I got brown hair on my head, red beard, blonde as can be, arm hair and leg hair. It's just a cabbage patch doll of
wow. So okay, so we'll let the Yeti slide then. I thought that you were redheaded, and I'm like, hey, that doesn't make any sense at all, you know. You'd be closer to a Bigfoot.
I don't know what I am.
Well, then that name fits you perfectly because nobody knows what a Yeti is. So, hey, what is, besides, let's not talk about Greenfield Village for this question, but the favorite event you've ever attended as a player?
A couple years ago, there's a Frontier League team over in Northern Kentucky called the Florence Freedom, and they changed their name now to the Florence Y'all. they have a 4th of July party that they host on the July 3rd, and for some reason the team was out of town for that time. And so they invited the Buckeyes and the Red Stockings to come up to their stadium and play. And there must have been 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 people in and out of the stadium, walking around, fireworks, and all kinds of festival stuff going on, and you know, announcing, playing this game in front of a huge, huge crowd. And that was like really, really fun. First time playing on AstroTurf. It was just a completely different feel to the game.
Were you playing bound on that?
Yeah, and that ball can bounce on AstroTurf.
Right. So there was the games went by quick, probably.
Yeah, we ended up playing a full nine, and we ended up losing to the Red Stockings. And disappointing day. It was a great time, though. I mean, it was just fun. And after the game, you know, we went and talked to a lot of the people there and obviously raised the awareness of vintage baseball for a substantial amount of the crowd over there.
Okay, you know, earlier, some other time in the past that we've talked, you referred to the Buckeyes and the Red Stockings as a Harlem Globetrotters capital situation. Who's the Harlem Globetrotters in that formula?
It always seems to be one or the other team. Every game seems to be a shellacking to somebody. We play an end-of-the-year game in honor of Danny Lyons, and we call it the something ball game.
Is it baseball game? Is it the baseball game, Landon?
Well, it's a baseball game, but we sign every year. The score gets written on the ball, trophy ball. It's a trophy ball, and then so the winning club takes home the trophy ball, and the scores are usually like the contending about how high you can count on those things, and you know, we've had a good run. We've lost the last 2 years to the Red Stockings, but I think my first 5 years in that, we tried to be the bane of their existence. We did a solid bang up job on it.
You referred to some geocaching, and I had to look it up to see what it was. So I Googled it, mm-hmm. and we're going to get to it later. I've never heard of that, and that is amazing. But what I want to get to right now is the fact that you are heavy into tree climbing, and you're some sort of manager of the Global Organization of Tree Climbers. So talk to me about that.
Okay. So I had a bunch of friends. We're into climbing. Ohio doesn't have like any cliffs or anything like that, you know, nothing real easy to go to. And trees are a big thing around here. So it became a hobby to try to scale trees. My dad's on the rope rescue team at work.
Why are you doing this with your dad?
He's really not that much older than me. He should be able to take this abuse, but he basically showed me some low, very rough climbing stuff, and I got really into it, and I was looking to further my knowledge and teach some other people some stuff, and there's a group of people just on the other side of the river in North Kentucky that had like a ropes course class, and I got signed up with them. And they did like a 3-day course on how to tie all these knots, how to be safe, how to put other people in tree, use this type of gear, blah, blah, blah. And I just completely fell in love with it. And then I found out that there was a big rendezvous of these people coming in like a month into this in the northern Kentucky. And I signed up to go to that, and I met like 130 other people who climbed trees and listened to their interesting stories, and they all had nicknames. So I got the name Yeti, kind of went with it. And eventually I liked the organization so much, and it's a global organization, that I became the president of it. Was the president of it for about 5.5 years. I gave that up in October, just some life circumstances with the wife and stuff like that. I had to like kind of set off to the side and make that tough decision so they could further their message and I could focus on family.
So your extreme height and shoe size probably help a lot in the climbing of trees, would you say?
Yeah, I have a hard time getting through branches. They hang up quite a bit. Most of the people that you see climbing are little stick guys that, you know, their strength to weight ratio is really good. And they go up. There's a couple of us that are the bigger ones that you're not sure if the tree's climbing us or I'm climbing the tree. So I wouldn't say it makes it easy to grab the next branch sometimes.
What is big tree hunting?
Nationally, Matt, there's one tree of a species that is the largest tree in the country. And then there's also state champions, which are the largest tree of that species in the state. So we were trying to find the biggest species of a tree in the country and in the state, and then you measure them accordingly to their rules, and then you would submit them and, you know, for location. And sometimes, like, a lot of them are on parks or in cemeteries. It's pretty common places to see big trees. Parks like to have that, you know, they sometimes might get funding or be able to cure land based upon if they have a champion tree. So a lot of park officials were asking us to come out and climb trees, which is, having somebody come and ask you to climb a tree in the park is kind of an odd thing. So we were using this as a way to open up tree climbing, offer services to like the Department of Natural Resources and parks and kind of gain a relationship, but also get, you know, kind of cool to find like the biggest tree of some species in another area and have your name associated with it on a website. You get to see big trees.
If you did a tree climbing with your dad, we should probably talk about an injury that happened then, shouldn't we?
Yeah, we could do that.
I'm assuming.
Tree climbing thing. It wasn't necessarily directly tree climbing, so this kind of misses the geocaching a little bit with the tree climbing. So we actually did a cave rappel. And I told my dad, I said, hey, there's this cave in Kentucky. I want to drop down into it using my tree climbing gear. And I'm going to go down there and do this for my birthday. And he's like, I'm going to go down there and make sure nobody gets hurt. I want to make sure you guys are doing this right. So we travel about 3 hours down in Kentucky, in Somerset, Kentucky, and on a private land. And you know, it's kind of open to the public, but private land. And we're walking over to this cave. And I'm ahead of the gang, you know, and carrying gear. And everybody's carrying a little bit of gear here and there. And we had walkie-talkies. And guy radios was, hey, Landon, it's your dad. I'm like, yeah, what's going on? He's like, he thinks he broke his arm. What? Give him the walkie-talkie. He's like, yeah, I stepped up on a tree, it's wet, I slipped off and I snapped my arm. Like, you broke your arm walking to the cave and you're the safety guy. Like, do you have your gun on you?
Oh,
just go ahead.
Just
use it.
Yeah, it's time.
he was a good sport. I mean, he knows. We've been around with broken bones and stuff like that. We set his arm, and we wrapped it with some bark and wrapped it up, and we did the cave rappel, and then got him back after we got them, basically, to the hospital. No harm, no foul, and you know, another case of they shouldn't hang out together.
When you broke your ankle sliding into third base, you know, I don't know how I know this story, but and you gave up on baseball.
You know,
was your dad part of that?
Well, so, you know, I started playing at 4 years old, playing T-ball, and my dad was part of the coaching team, and he was lead umpire, and, you know, and he was there throughout my whole ball career. And then when I was 13 years old, still playing knothole baseball, he gave me the old steel sign, steel third base from second. And I did, and I slid, and my cleats caught, and I snapped my ankle, tackled the third baseman. Ankle swelled up like a giant grapefruit. It sounded like a shotgun going off. I rolled over, and knew things weren't right, and he was just kind of beside himself. He grabbed my ankle like he was, you know, making sure I didn't have a spinal injury, and he's just holding my ankle and just kind of crept down. And people were coming over to me like, "Man, you all right? You all right?" I'm like, "I'm fine, but check that guy down there, man. He looks bad."
But the stories of you guys getting injured around each other don't stop there. There's a story about how you got hit in the head by your dad during a sporting activity.
Well, we were actually working on a house together. We built a house. I'm big into working on houses, and that he built houses and things. We're over at his house. We just wired up a pole pump, and my mom pops out and says, "Hey, food's almost ready." So we stop what we're doing, and then she pops out and says, potatoes aren't soft yet. You know, they're going to be a little bit longer. They got a little pond out there, and I'll grab a fishing pole, and I'll go out there and cast out the pond. I cast out the pond, reel back in. All of a sudden, something just drills me in the head, knocks me off my feet, goes in the water. And they live out in the kind of country area where it's not too uncommon to hear a gunshot or something like that. I'm thinking a bullet hit me in the head. I'm bleeding all over. I got, you know, head wounds bleed a lot. I've got blood all over my arm, all over my shirt, everything like that. I'm beside myself. I'm like freaking out. My dad comes running over to me. My sister comes running over to me. My wife comes running over to me. And I'm sitting there like trying to figure out what's going on. And my dad's like, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to. And we get up and we're walking inside the house. And then he's like, I just wanted to throw that dirt clod in the water to make you think a fish jumped. I was like, what? So he looks at my head, and it's split open pretty good. He pulled this dirt clump out of a tractor tire, so it was all packed up and everything like that. And he says, "You got to go to the hospital." So we go to the hospital, and I go into the waiting room, and the lady calls me back, and she's like, "Hey, I got to ask you some questions before we admit you in it." So I'm like answering questions of, you know, who I am, what happened, blah. And she's like, "So your dad hit you in the head with a dirt club?" And I'm like, "Yeah." She goes, "Well, is this on purpose or accident?" I was like, "It was on accident." And she goes, "Would you like me to have the police pick him up?" And I'm looking through this glass window into like the waiting room, and he's in there. And he's never met a stranger in his life. And he's hiking back like a football, telling everybody else the story of this great throw he just did. And he's reenacting the whole throw like he was, you know, on purpose or something like that. I'm looking out there. Man, I really should have this asshole picked up. You know, I didn't, and it was right before Father's Day, and I still gave him this gift, everything like that. But they all turn into great stories in hindsight, you know.
Well, sure. I was just looking at this, and you've actually broken your arm 5 times.
Yeah, I fell out of a tree, fell off of a hillside. Grew tall before I really knew how to utilize it. Fell off of a basketball rim, got tackled into a wall, punched a roll of plastic. Just arms. It just, things break. Well, broke my finger twice.
It sounds like you're safer
are we alive? No, how are we alive?
It sounds like you're safer when you play vintage baseball. You're the only one who's safer on the field.
Oh, yeah, yeah. If you watch me walk a line from point A to point B, like, how is that guy not, like, on the ground constantly? And then you see me up in a tree, and he's like, he is perfectly balanced up here. And he's running across the field just fine. But any other time, he struggles.
Hey, you got a vintage story about Drifter. What was that all about?
Well, this ties into me getting hurt again. So, you know, vintage baseball. I've been very, very fortunate, and you know, and I made the stupid comment that, am I the only one here who hasn't been hurt playing vintage baseball? I made it literally before we started playing this game. And do you know Drifter?
I know who he is.
Okay, so he usually plays first base. He's playing catcher for us, and he's a gamer. I mean, he is a gamer. He wants to win. He wants to win big. And he is part of the solution to win big. I play shortstop. Ball goes past him, and he gets to the ball, runner stealing. And he comes up, and he's got this anger in his eyes. I mean, I lock eyes with people a lot, and you can see a lot in their eyes, I feel like, when you're playing ball with somebody, what they're going to do. He unyields this throw. It's coming right at me, wide, though. And it nails me right in the pinky finger and just completely knocks my fingernail off. And blood just splatters out on the day that I said I've never been hurt in vintage.
Of course.
Completely
so
decapitated my fingernail.
So you threw some dirt on it and you finished the game. You went to the hospital and got a thing on it.
I came out of the game, wiped the blood off, and then came back in the next inning.
Yeah, once you knock the nail off, what are you going to do?
Yeah, there's nobody going to solve that thing.
I don't know. It makes me queasy to think about.
Haven't you ever knocked the nail off?
No, I have not. Oh, and I don't want to.
It's not as bad.
And I'm not.
You do it three or four times, and then you get used to it.
Knocking all these things off my list. Like, I'm never going to go climb a tree now because you've broken your
climbing butt. Trees are pretty safe. Just don't be walking to a cave.
Oh. And some of your hobbies are not quite as dangerous. So are you a gamer?
I really enjoy PUBG Mobile. I'm really into that. A lot of mobile games and things along those lines, but PUBG Mobile was a big one. Have you played that?
No, I never heard of it until I looked it up because I saw it on your questionnaire. So explain that. What is that?
So it's a what they call a battle royale style game. The game that's similar to that is Fortnite.
Okay.
It's not as cartoony, and it's kind of more in the physics that we're used to. When you jump, you only jump a couple feet. You're not like flying around or anything too crazy. But it's a first person shooter kind of concept where you 100 people drop into a map and it's whoever can survive.
And like Fortnite, from what I know about Fortnite, because my sons are addicted, you don't have a choice who the other 99 people are, right? So you can't play with your friends. You're just, it's random.
Well, you can do duos and squads concept. But other than that, if you really want to play with your own friends, you can create what they call rooms. And then you advertise like a code to get into a room, and you can control who gets into that and team up and things like that. But other than that, it's kind of random grab of whoever is out there trying to buy to get into the room.
At first, when I looked it up, I thought it was something like the Pokemon where you're going around and you're capturing Pokemon. But then I looked up geocaching, and basically that's what that is almost. I mean, in a sense, which is not a mobile game. Except the GPS that you're using. Talk to me. No, you know what? We're going to save that for the end. I really want to get into that. We have 1,061, what do you call those? I looked it up. Places you can geocache in Saginaw here where I live. Is that a lot?
It is. It is a lot. It's not probably the most dense. But those things are everywhere. I mean, you can go even get one at this International Space Station. Outside of like North Korea, you can find them like anywhere on the globe.
Well, yeah, because
Antarctica and everything too.
North Korea doesn't allow you to have a device with a GPS on it, so that's the only reason they're against that there. Hey, you mentioned earlier, and I wanted to get into this, and you're a good sport to get into this. But your wife has been experiencing some illness. She's been pretty miserable, from what I can tell. And it's not exactly getting figured out as to what's going on. Could you, and as much as you want, and you don't have to talk about anything you don't want to, but give me an idea of what's going on with her.
So back in last April, she was having some episodes of dizziness and headaches and stuff. She's had headaches before, but nothing that like lasted long, nothing that was frequent or anything along those lines. But the dizziness started getting progressively worse and not going away. Roughly about June of 2019, she basically experienced an episode that just did not go away at all. And initially what they found out was your vestibular system, which is your internal ear, something had infected her nerve going from that vestibular system to her brain and diminished the signaling. So now her balance of where she is in space was lost. She had her eyes that she could see where she was. She could have her muscle, you know, they call it a feedback of where she's at, but that didn't agree with the internal ear that you use constantly. So it created a dizziness effect that conflicted because, you know, just imagine spinning around all the time. And was what she was feeling.
Is this something that she would feel a majority of the time, or is this something that would just come on?
It started out as a come on type thing in it, but then once it hit, it was 24/7. So even, you know, she would have dreams that she was dizzy. She woke up and she was just instantly dizzy. It was just kind of rudely there at all times. Now they found that pretty quickly, that issue, and she went through a physical therapy. And they worked on that. They do a physical therapy, a vestibular therapy that is a lot of head turning and a lot of weights. And basically what you're doing is you're retraining your eyes and your brain and your feedback loop to associate with what you have left. Some of it you might recover. There's no guarantee to that. But her therapy basically works with that. And it's one of these things where you want to go to the wall, but you don't want to push through the wall, kind of like a physical injury. You know, you can work up and it's very easy to tell where you're, I'm tired now. The vestibular system and that type of therapy is like, it's all kind of a guess because after you're done, you may get even worse off and you don't want to go past that line because then your brain just kind of like loses that, that learning. It's kind of a weird thing in a way to describe it. We kept wanting to associate it with a physical injury because we're obviously very familiar with them. But this was something just oddly different. And luckily there was physical therapist that actually could explain this pretty easily and work with us on that. But things with that got really, really good until second week of November. And then it like jumped back in and changed. Her dizziness changed, migraines swept in and became continuous. She obviously, being struck with something like anybody that'd be hit with something for a long period of time of that type, mental health kind of kicks in. So we had to address mental health with therapy and those type of stuff. But now we're trying to manage anxiety, depression, and get into that realm in migraine management, which she hasn't had a whole lot of luck with the medication of migraines in it. They're looking at doing maybe an implant or some other things in order to mitigate the migraines. And hopefully everything kind of comes down together. And she actually is starting to have some effects. Like she has some moments where she's not feeling dizzy anymore. The migraines very diminished now. So we're seeing some very big improvements. It's just it's hard for her being caught in the storm to see the improvements. So it's you know, all the time I'm trying to reassure her that things are getting better, and it's, you know, kind of a little bit of a drain in that regard.
And I mentioned something to you on the onlines about possibly looking into the cannabis. Even just the oils. I've never had any experience with the marijuana or the cannabis for medicinal purposes. So I cannot speak as to how effective they are. I can only go on stories I've heard and things I've heard from other people, especially when it comes to migraines and anxiety and stuff like that, how it really calms down. And so look into that. You might find an easy, temporary, obviously very temporary, solution in that way. Have you looked into it at all?
she's had some experience with the cannabinoid stuff. The problem is that before it really became a legal drug to really kind of get into, you really didn't know what you were getting a hold of. So experimenting in that realm was not really fun. And the only other issue within the medical field right now, if she was to get into it right now, there'd be a lot of experimentation. Because, you know, as you probably seen, there's tons of strands and different strengths and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And she's had some adverse effects with some of them and good effects with some of them. But trying to figure out which one on the shelf would wear be kind of a long-term experience. And so she's kind of been kind of put off on that right now, not wanting to get into something that might make her feel really, really worse or not really know where we're going with it. No, so it's kind of it's definitely something we were looking into, but it's not something that we know that we can really. It's we don't know which direction to go because there's so many directions. We'd have to talk to somebody who probably has a lot more knowledge of which strands and things like that. And it still would be kind of a fight for her to take something because she's kind of antsy on taking things because it usually goes one way or the other, and if it stays in your system very long and it's bad, it can really affect a lot of the progress that we've been through.
So this has probably affected her on many levels. Can she work while this is going on?
She can't work. She can't drive. She can't read a book. Her eyes can't focus well enough. And she was the type of person that read a book a week. She can't look at the TV, her phone. So she's kind of disconnected from stuff. Her human interaction has been people coming over and hanging out with her. So it's a big kickback.
And you guys are off to the doctors quite a bit. You guys have lots of appointments and stuff, am I right?
Yeah. This type of stuff, and that the doctors aren't necessarily, nothing's like, you're this, go there. And you're kind of dealing with multiple things. So with migraine, there's a migraine doctor in neurology because things change so suddenly that we wanted to look at that type of stuff. And, you know, neurologist was like, we had to like kind of jump ship to another medical group because a neurologist appointment was like 7 months out with the group that we've been seeing. So it's been a little bit of a learning experience in all medical fields. She has some blood work coming up. Just to make sure there's not something like an autoimmune involved or Lyme disease and a couple other little things along those lines.
Is your insurance helping you a lot during this, or are we running into problems?
The insurance has actually been great. I actually work for Ford Motor Company as a maintenance electrician, and our insurance has been very, very good. It's one of the major perks of the job. Outside of the vestibular therapy, the group that they wanted us to go to was kind of a distance away, and driving was rough for her, so we paid out of pocket for that. But other than that, we haven't paid much out of pocket. We've been very fortunate in that realm.
Well, definitely keep us up to date. I know there's a large contingency of people in the vintage community keeping an eye on that. It's an unfortunate thing.
The vintage people have been amazing in suggesting items and you know, talking and just keeping us in our heads too. In a family that's been very, very close, Mitch, and very, very, I've been very, very happy with my vintage family. I mean, it's been major reach out amongst all branches of it, and I'm very happy for that too.
Yeah, they do. It is a wonderful brother and sisterhood, the vintage community, and it's a lot more than just baseball that keeps people coming back. That is for sure.
There's a lot off the field. There's a lot off the field.
Hey, Landon, before I let you go, I really want to get into the geocaches. Like I said, there's 1,061 geocaches around Saginaw. How many would you estimate are around Cincinnati? You're probably talking 10,000?
So there's a density thing with geocaching. They can only be so close to each other, a tenth of a mile. You can't have them completely piled on. And there's a couple different styles. But I would say there's probably in the Cincinnati area, there's probably a good 5,000.
Okay. Explain to everybody who's never heard of it before, which is 99% of the people who are about to hear this, what is geocaching?
The simple one-line tagline of geocaching would be that it is a GPS treasure hunting game. So people hide a container, and the minimum thing is it needs to be something with a logbook so you can sign your name saying you were there, and they hide it, and then they post a coordinate to their best ability of where that is, and then they post it on geocaching.com, and then basically your job is to go out, find that container, and sign your name. So the big thing with draw of the geocaching concept would be that sometimes the location that takes you to is an unknown location that you haven't been familiar with. There's been one down the street for me that weren't like spectacular finds or hard to find, but it took me to a place that I didn't know or introduced me to something that it was in that location. Sometimes the container itself is a jigsaw puzzle, so it's not just about finding it, it's about how do you get it open. Sometimes the location takes you to a place and then explains a bit of history there. So if you're into history, those things are cool. Sometimes they're puzzles. So you have to solve a puzzle, which reveals a location. Then you go and find the container at that the unknown location that you discover.
And that's all dependent on the person putting the, is it called a geocache? What is the actual, the box that you are, you're finding that's got the logbook in it? What are those actually called?
They're just called geocaches.
Okay.
Or a cache.
So these caches, it's up to the people that are hiding these things to what you have to go through as far as finding a puzzle to find the location or whatever. Is that correct?
Correct. Each container has a difficulty, a container size, and a terrain difficulty. So a one would be something that somebody can roll up in a wheelchair or with a disability and easily grab. A five would be that you need specialized gear. So that example when my dad fell into the cave was a cave rappel 92 feet into a cave to get a geocache, which would be a five terrain.
So I'm looking at a video at the top of geocaching.com/play, and it's showing this little video of people finding things that are in this, and there's a nut and bolt magnetized to a bottom of a table that's got the logo on it, and people are finding a box with items in it, and this box has a monkey action figure, and there's a logbook. So basically, what do you sign your name in that logbook, or what is the logbook for?
Yeah, the logbook is just proof that you're there to verify. So you can't just like log in and go and say I found all of them, you know. You actually, people can go there and verify that you actually found them if they so choose to keep the credibility of the finding and the finder.
Is there any contests that go along with this? Are you like is there like a standings thing or anything like that?
There's some like third party groups that like list how many of you found. And you know, there's people that have found over 100,000 of these things, travel around the country and the world looking for them. There's little challenges like find one in all seven continents. There's find one that, you know, the name starts with every letter of the alphabet in a certain amount of time. Find one every day for a whole year. Little challenges like that that people do, but there's no you win anything. You know, it's just all like look at me, I did this type of stuff.
Yeah, I tell you what I'm going to do is I'm actually going to sign up and make an account on this, and I'm going to give this a shot and see what is around here. And I'll get back to you on what I find. And you've probably found just about everything in Cincinnati, so you probably look forward to leaving town, right?
Yeah, and that's kind of how I got into it initially because before I worked for Ford, and then I was a electrician contractor and did a little bit of traveling with that. And we would go to these towns where there just wasn't anything. And, you know, people were working 14, 16 hour days, and, you know, getting them to hang out with you after something like that was kind of hard. You know, everybody wanted to just go home and go to sleep. So you'd have dead moments where there wasn't anything to do. And somebody introduced me to that. And then so here I am in middle Louisiana, hunting around in bayous and stuff like that, looking for containers, while nothing else really to do because there wasn't really anything to do around these areas.
So, do they,
so
like,
it was a good time filler, you know.
Did they put some of these caches in the water? So where you're looking at, looking for an above water kind of marker?
You can't assume anything. In a sense, I found a guy had a one with a rock with a Tabasco bottle plugged, and it was in the water, and the bottle was floating about 2 feet off the bottom, not at the surface of the water, and a log book inside that. So you have to like wade through the water to find them. I've seen them on buoys in the river. I've seen them up in trees 100 feet. I've crawled through drainage tunnels to get them. Police have pulled me out of all kinds of holes and crevices with this stuff. If you can imagine it, somebody has probably thought about hiding a geocache container there.
So when the police pull you out of places, do they know what you're doing because other people have done it?
It seems to have gained more popularity than when I first, I mean, I wasn't necessarily in the geocaching early, but it was probably about 10% of the cops knew what we were doing. The other ones in that, you know, were a little bit more inquisitive. You would show them your GPS and kind of show them the app or something like that, that you're doing, kind of like show them that you're doing something. You might even have like a little card, to do stuff. Cause you know, after 9/11, people were a little suspicious. One of the ones that I had that was kind of rough is there was like an 18-inch culvert pipe at this church. And you know, I'm driving around on a Sunday, and here I am. There's the whole church is just tons of people there, you know. And I'm sitting outside going, should I go over that culvert pipe underneath that driveway there, or their driveway, and climb into this thing? And I was like, yep, I'm going to do it because that's why I'm here. So I'm, you know, inchworming through this culvert pipe, and it's drilled to the top of the culvert pipe. So you have inch in, and you know, I'm just kind of working like a little weird animal on this box inside of my name. And then I'm inching out. As soon as my head pops out, there's a sheriff standing right above me. What are you doing? Planting a bomb? No. I could see how it looked like that. If you look in there, there's a box drilled to the top of the culvert pipe. You get used to kind of talking to people about it a little bit, you know, much like vintage baseball. You know, people look at you weird when they first hear you're not doing gloves and that type of stuff. And then you show them enough evidence that that's real, and they kind of buy into it.
Yeah, it does look, it looks like an incredible hobby.
You have kids?
All my kids are grown and gone. So, I have a 22-year-old that lives in Phoenix, Arizona right now, and I have a 20-year-old who's in the Marines in California. I have a 26-year-old who lives in Bay City, which is close here to Saginaw. And at home here, I have a 13-year-old stepdaughter who, actually, this sounds like it's right up her alley, and she's nice and skinny to get into some places. I'm already working on this in my head.
You're gonna turn into me and my dad. You're gonna be one of these guys. Like, one of you gonna be broken every time you go out. Most kids like the bigger containers because there's usually knickknacks and stuff and hidden in them, so they can. Usually, the concept is you take something, you leave something, you know, kind of trade toys or knickknacks or little souvenir type things. And then the other concept that geocaches kind of usually bring up is that, you know, if you see garbage while you're hiking in somewhere, just pick it up and take it out. So they call that cache in, trash out. So it's kind of a, you know, you're enjoying the park and you're kind of being responsible for the park, you know, leave no trace kind of concepts.
So you climb trees, you hunt trees, and you also hug trees. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah. And they break me sometimes. I mean, that, you know, I've climbed trees in Costa Rica, climbed redwoods out in California, climbed in probably 20-something different states around, you know, with people, camped in trees, you know, camped 160 feet up in trees, you know, so it's a completely different world, you know, when you tilt your head up a little bit, not just after a nice crack of a bat looking at a ball flying out.
Sure. You ever climb a tree and break a branch and make a baseball bat out of it?
You know, I've been wanting to get a bat made. You know, you remember the old big red wiffle ball bats?
Yes.
I want to make one of those out of wood. I've been looking for a good log that's laying around or something like that to have one of my friends throw in his lathe and make up. I just think that'd be a cool bat just to mess around with or use as a commemorative type game trophy kind of thing.
Okay, Landon. We're going to bring this to an end. It has been fantastic to get you to talk to you. We've been social media buddies for a couple of months, but now we get to talk and get to know each other a little bit better, and that's what the podcast is about. Now everybody knows a bunch of stuff about you, so everywhere, anybody who listens to this episode is now going to ask you a bunch of questions that have nothing to do with vintage baseball.
I look forward to it.
And look forward to seeing you in June for the festival, and I think I'll see you again in October for the tournament championship down in Columbus. And that's going to bring her to an end. Just don't forget, everybody listening out there in the world, I drop a new episode every Wednesday. You can find the Rolling Around the Barrel podcast Facebook page by that name. You can go to www.strikewellgents.org. Landon, you've listened to every single episode, am I right?
I have. Yeah.
What's your favorite episode so far?
Well, it's hard not to be enticed by the history of marbles. I really kind of like it. I do like the fact that there's guys that, I don't know anything about. So this last one with Peaches, and that was just kind of neat to hear about the, how their association started and kind of rolled out. It was an avenue of things that I didn't really think about. So it was kind of neat to learn about how they do it down there. So probably the Peaches one has probably been one of my favorites at this point in time, because it was a whole different realm of things that I haven't even really associated yet with vintage baseball.
And there was so much vintage baseball to talk about with Brad that I didn't get to know anything about him. He's one of the people I might have to have a part two with in the future, just so I can figure something out about him. But he knew so much about vintage baseball, it was hard to get away from it.
Yeah, all I knew about him was his name. He was from Georgia, right?
Yes, originally from, I want to say Decatur, Georgia. I don't know why that's in my head. From Georgia. He was an Atlanta Falcons fan. I knew that, and I didn't even have enough time to make fun of that. Oh, jeez, so disappointing. Landon, thank you for coming on to the show. I appreciate it. Take care. Prayers out to your wife, and I hope everything starts settling down and you get the correct diagnosis as far as what they can do to make it go away.
I appreciate it. Thanks, Matt, and thanks to the Vintage Baseball family, man. It's been really nice to me.
All right, everybody, take care. Semper Fi, Ashton.
Post-game show is brought to you by... Christ, I can't find it. The hell with it.